Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Wrestling with Freddie. And today's guest is a close friend of mine. I can count on two fingers how many of my friends are wrestlers, and I can count on one finger how many of them I'm this close with. And today's guest, I've wanted to have him on since the very first episode because I talk about him in just about every episode. We have the amazing MVP.
Now, stepping up to the mic, the host of Wrestling with Freddie, Freddie Prinze Jr.
So I've graduated to fully amazing because I've always been half man.
No, you're fully amazing now. Full man, full amazing. It's a whole new category, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, man. I'm actually in my hotel room in Orlando right now going through my physical, physical assessment to get cleared to get back in the ring because, you know, I had that knee injury for a while.
How'd the physical therapy go?
It's all healed up. So now it's just a matter of me, jumping through their hoops to make sure that I'm physically capable of performing in the ring. So I'm feeling good, man. The knee injury, the torn meniscus is completely healed. And now it's just a matter of, you know, rebuilding the strength in the leg from the atrophied muscle. My teardrop is gone, non-existent. So we're working on building that back up. And my cardio. My cardio was much better than I thought it would be because I'd actually, you know, hired a trainer and I've been, you know, working on it. So I'm further along than I thought I would be. Fortunately, I wasn't, you know, on my back gasping for air. But I feel pretty damn good.
Now, for what you do outside of the ring, everything you're talking about is equally, if not more so, important. So I wanted to start the story by how we met, but I just want to jump right into a mutual love that you and I both have, which is...
No, let's talk about how we met.
Okay. So, all right, here we go. Okay. So I had been at the company for 18 seconds, and you were working with a writer named Krista Joseph on a promo, and I was kind of hiding back in the shadows listening in because you guys were having a speed bump in there, and I was trying to like analyze what the problem was and if I could fix it. And once I did, I was like a dog that hasn't been trained yet on a leash. Like I was jumping, waiting for an opportunity where there was like going to be a pause in the creative flow that I could jump in, right? And be like, hey, what about this? And I saw that pause and I jumped in and you looked at me like you were going to beat the living shit out of me. And what was going through your head at that moment? Because this is like my favorite memory in the company.
Well, we got to go back a little bit before that. You know, my only knowledge of Freddie Prinze Jr. was She's All That and fucking Tiger Beat. And
he's such a jerk.
I'm like, you mean that dude from those cheesy movies?
That dude.
And he's going to tell me about wrestling? This guy? So I was more than just a little offended. And Joseph said, hey, yeah, we're going to have Freddie working with us today on this promo. And I'm like, man, I don't need that old candy-ass Hollywood dude coming over here telling me about how to cut a promo. And we were working. I remember it was SummerSlam with Jeff Hardy, and it was the go-home. And Joseph was like, hey, man, he's really cool, man. Just give him a chance. Give him a chance. And I'm just, you know, gritting my teeth like, I'm a professional. I work with anybody, but I'm not going to like it. And we had crafted a pretty good promo, but like you said, there was just that one beat missing, that one thing to tie it all together, that one line. And I remember you pacing back and forth, and everybody was sitting there just kind of trying to find that one piece. And you turned, you said, okay, how about this? And the funny thing is, I don't even remember what it was. I just remember when you said it, Joseph looked up, his eyes lit up. And I looked at you angry because that shit was good. I was mad. Like, how dare he? But then I had to go like, no, that's it. That's the piece. And I proceeded to cut the promo. Vince loved it. Everybody loved it. You know, everybody came back, giving me a pat on the back. What a great promo. What a great. And then I was like, I grudgingly had to give you your props. I said, all right, well. Maybe there's more to this guy. And after that, you invited me to come hang out with you and Mac. And we had some vibes, shall we say. It's because then we started talking about pop culture and movies. And I remember specifically talking about Dennis Alexio and Bronco.
That's right. And you were the only, like the only other dude I've ever known that knew that fight. And oh my God, I can't believe I forgot this. And you said it and my eyes, just like they just did now, just went pop, like right out of my head. And I'm like, this guy knows about ISKA kickboxing? Like, that's insane. What are your obsessions?
And it was at that moment that I think our bond was set at never to be broken, because I was like, okay, man, you know what? I was a jerk. And I was very, and at that time, you know, I was still adhering to WWE at that point was transitioning from the old school to the new school. They had just a little while before that gone corporate and things were changing. And I was still in that old school mentality, not understanding the evolution or realizing at that time, I still wasn't really clear on the evolution of what was happening. I mean, it was never like a sit down meeting to explain how, okay, all that old pro wrestling stuff, yeah, some of that stuff we're still going to keep. But going forward, we are an entertainment conglomerate and we're not in the wrestling business. We're in the television business, and all that came later. So at the time, you know, I'm still protecting the business from, you know, from the Hollywood
outside. Jerks like me.
Yeah, you. The guy was on the cover of Teen Beat, but he's going to tell me how to cut a promo. Get out of here. But, you know, you obviously were very good at what you do, and, you know, you contributed well, and you're a genuinely good person. And I had to eat a whole lot of crow.
Nah, it wasn't any crow. I understood it. And I told you this when we first met, like, we kind of both bonded because we have old school mentalities and we believe in earning respect, but giving dignity, right? Like, everyone deserves dignity, but yeah, Everyone should have to earn your respect, and respect should be earned on a case by case basis. I can't just walk in the room and say, well, my movie did brr, 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 so you should listen to me, because you tell me to go screw myself, right? So I have to kind of,
I don't care about your movie. Have you ever been choke slammed by the Undertaker?
No, nor would I have been. Dude, I took one damn bump from Randy Orton when I was like a guest general manager of Raw, and he did that modified like backbreaker on me where he catches you from behind and put, bro, I was stiff for like 3 days after that. Like, it, and I'm sitting there going, yo, it was like 4 or 5 days later, I was with Macaulay, and I'm like, man, I still hurt. And meanwhile, that guy's had like 9 matches since that night. Like, I don't understand. Okay, you brought up Bronco and Dennis, which brings me to my godfather, Bob Wall, who recently passed away. He was Dennis's manager, and he was also the man who introduced me to Jean-Jacques Machado and my introduction to jiu-jitsu. So you and I started taking jiu-jitsu seriously much later in life, and we both clicked to it the way, like, former addicts click with church or AA or whatever it is, to the point where we preach it, right? We preach it like it's religion. Because I'm not going to say it saved my life, but it certainly changed my life and sculpted and molded me into a much more productive and destructible man. And when I say destructible, I mean when challenges come at me, I see so many more options to solve problems now than I did before I took jiu-jitsu seriously. Now, you and I used to be sort of on the same path as far as techniques we were learning and how our skills were developing. You're obviously much bigger and stronger than me, but our belts were the same. And then I had a slight injury that took me off the mats, and your jiu-jitsu continued to grow and grow and grow, and you started to want to compete and actually go against legit dudes, which brings me to the IBJJF. And you won. You won. their championship. Will you please break this down? Because I don't know the tournament scene at all, man. At all. Break down the whole process from start. Were you nervous? Were you cocky? Were you humbled? Were you empowered? All the way to the end, please.
Well, let's go back to when I first started with jiu-jitsu, with BJJ, Brazilian jiu-jitsu. When I was wrestling for New Japan at the time. I had asked for my release from WWE and to go realize my dream of wrestling in Japan. And I was over there for a couple years, and I had had a chance to spend a little time in the ring. I had, you know, some opportunities to work on some shoot style stuff with him in the ring a little bit. And actually with Shinsuke too. He was a purple belt at the time. And I, as a pro wrestler, I was always a fan of the shoot style, you know, and I liked, you know, the legitimacy of, you know, the realistic style. So when I gave my notice to New Japan, I said, hey, look, I'm just going to take a year off from wrestling. There was a Gracie Baja down the street from my house. I used to drive past it all the time. And I finally said, all right, today's the day. I'm going to give this a shot. Because I knew I wanted to take some time off and I needed something to devote myself to. I think I had maybe a stripe on my white belt. And all the guys were telling me, man, yo, we got a NAGA tournament coming up. And NAGA is the North American Grappling Association. It's not on the same level as the IBJJF because IBJJF is the sports governing body. But NAGA is, you know, probably the second largest competition, but it's a lot more for children and a lot more of the hobbyists, not quite as serious. I mean, there are some, you know, not to belittle it at all, but so I said, all right, man, you know, I'll give it a shot. As a matter of fact, I want to say I did that tournament after I came back from L.A. when you and I rolled with Henner for the first time.
That's exactly when it happened.
A couple days with Josh. Yeah, I spent a couple days training with Josh Barnett, with Henner. And I came back and I was like, man, my jiu-jitsu is, you know, because I was singing the gospel of jiu-jitsu, a new convert. And I did my first NAGA tournament and I did gi and no gi. And I competed ultra heavyweight. So I'm, you know, the one guy, I'm not exaggerating at all. This guy looked like a sumo wrestler. He was well over 400 pounds. And my thought process was like, man, please don't let this guy get on top of me because I don't have the skill set to get him off right now. But I was able to take him down and submit him. And there were two guys. And then in gi, it was the same thing. As a matter of fact, a technique that we had worked on that week, Osotogari in gi, I hit it twice, moved to mount armbar, and got, you know, two submissions. And I won two gold medals in my very first competition. That's so sick. And I was hooked. I was like, I'm in. And I was doing every tournament I could. I was driving to Dallas. I was driving all. I live in Houston. So I was driving all the tournaments. My first IBJJF I competed in, the Houston Open. I won that. And, you know, then I got my first promotion to blue belt. And then I realized, like, okay, you know, this is my thing now. You know, the adrenaline rush that I got from competing, because, you know, people would say to me, like, I would get nervous before a competition. And people would say, like, man, you perform in front of millions of people and you're nervous? I said, yeah, but I know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't know these guys. I don't know their skill set, their level. You know, it's just the nerves of the unknown. So when I and because I'm over 30, I compete in the Masters division, which is 30 and up. And the IBJJF has the regular and then the Masters. So 30 and up is Masters and under 30 is the regular. And my very first blue belt tournament for the Worlds in Las Vegas, I lost in the quarterfinals to the guy that went on to win the gold medal. So that made me feel a little bit better. That was the first time I had lost. Like every tournament I had done to that point, I was just submitting fools and you know, pointing fools left and right. And I was like, oh, I got this. And then I finally ran into me. And me and the guy laughed about it afterwards because he was like, yo, you're the first person that, you know, that I had a hard fight, because he was an amateur wrestler. I think he was an All-American. He was wrestled in the Army. Yeah. He was a firefighter. Yeah, so like he was fit, he was strong, he was skilled. And you know, talk about humility, because that was the first time I wasn't on the podium. And that hurt, especially when I saw like the guys in second and third that I would mop the match with those guys. But as the bracketing worked out, I ran into, you know, and that guy said, hey, man, if you would have been on the other side of the bracket, it would have been you and me in the finals. So I made it a point to continue competing, and I would go to Worlds every year after that and compete. And I remember at Purple Belt, my first time competing, I lost by a rest decision in the first round. Talk about humility. I had a three-month camp. My gas tank was deep. My skill set was on. And I went up against a Brazilian guy and the Brazilian ref. And then BJJ, they talk about the Brazilian curse. Don't leave it to the ref. And even my professor, Andre Santos, he said, ah, son, you know, I you can't leave it to the referee because, you know, I'm Brazilian. And if you fight a Brazilian guy, I'm going to give it to him.
That's a really, really solid impression, by the way. That's no joke. The Brazilian impression is on point. I thought I was talking to Jean-Jacques for a second.
I spent a lot of time with my professor, Andre Santos. And then finally, I think it was 3 years ago, I made it to the finals. And this is my shot. Here's my opportunity. And I went up against a guy named, I believe his name is Andre Bocchino. I didn't know this at first, but he's a four-time judo Olympian from Argentina.
Oh, yeah.
Pan Am Games silver medalist, you know. I didn't know this beforehand. I just mentioned big, tough-looking guy. But I noticed how his fingers were taped up. Like, that's not jujitsu tape. Like, you know.
He had those Gene LaBelle fingers.
Yeah, but, you know, he had them taped all the way up, complete, the first three on each hand. You know, I'm like, nobody does that. It's not like that, you know. But I was very impressed. I was very proud of that silver medal because he never took me down. He tripped me up a little bit a couple times, but I was able to stay on my feet and rest decision. He won, but my feelings weren't hurt because, I mean, to me, I kind of that silver medal I feel is lined with gold because an Olympian judoka didn't take me off my feet.
That's no joke.
And then I went to do the so at this point I'm done, right? I'm like, hey man, I had five matches today. Four matches. They all went the distance. I won on points on all of them except for the final one. My fingers were like, you know, clawed up. My forearms were like concrete footballs. I'm like, I'm done, man. You know, and my professor goes, no, now you have to do the absolute. You have to do it. I'm like, Andre, I'm done, man. I got nothing left in the tank. He says, yes, you do. I said, but look at my hands. I can't even make grips. He goes, no, when you grab the gi, your hand's going to lock and stay like that. You're going to be okay. And he was right. My muscles cramped up.
Because he's seen it a million times, man.
Yeah, he's a fourth degree black belt. He's been a black belt for 20 years. So he's like, nah, you're going to be okay. And I ended up taking bronze in the absolute. So that day I walked away with a silver and a bronze. And my feelings, you know, weren't hurt because I accomplished something. But I came back the next year, and I said, this year is mine. I'm gonna take it this year as a purple belt. And yeah, I was really nervous because I put a lot of pressure on myself because I had made the goal that I wanted to be a jiu-jitsu world champion. And I set that goal. And every year, me and Andre would talk about it. And I'm going to a camp 3 months out. And I, you know, as a month out from camp, I'm doing three-a-days. I'm going to jits in the morning, jits in the afternoon. Then I'm doing my weight training, my cardio routine. Then I'm going to evening jits. Like, I immersed myself in jits for that, you know, for that final month especially. Then I had the go day, and I was ready. And I had two competitors to face in my division. So I wasn't worried about my gas tank. And they were both big guys. And one guy, I actually saw some tape of him. So I knew, like, oh, man, this guy's legit. You know, he competes a lot. And the first guy I was able to beat pretty handily. I beat him on points. I didn't submit him. And the second guy, he was solid, man. He was good. And he pulled guard. And we were fighting and fighting and fighting. And then he was really tall. So he had long legs, and I was having a hard time passing his guard. And every time I would just about pass it, I'm almost there, he would recover. And I'm like, damn it, man. But fortunately, you know, I was aggressive enough in my attempts and my attacking that I won that. Finally, I got a ref's decision. And the guy, you know, he wasn't even disappointed about it, you know, because he acknowledged it. So I had the pleasure of standing on the podium that day, IBJJF Masters Worlds, on the number one spot. I got my gold medal, and just like I had visualized so many times, my professor came once they gave me my gold medal, and he took my purple belt off and put my brown belt around me. And you know, so many times I had fantasized about the day that I got promoted on the podium.
Oh, man.
And it happened. If you win the Worlds, if you compete in Worlds at whatever belt you're at,
you're
and you win,
up.
That's his belief. So I'm like, okay, cool. So now I'm a brown belt.
So I got 37 questions.
I got 38 answers.
You told me, you know, I'm training for the world championships again. You didn't tell me about three-a-days or any of this. You trained for this tournament the way a professional fighter trains for a fight. Yes? I mean, you were doing full diet.
Yeah.
How old were you when you were doing this?
45, 46.
What are you doing for recovery? What are you doing to be able to get in there and train every day? Or is it just the mental?
Both. I mean, you know, I'm a night owl, as you know. I like to be up at night, and, you know, but here's a crazy thing for me. I enjoy the benefits of cannabis. But I also realize that when I smoke, it affects my cardio. So one month out, I cut off smoking completely, and I was only using CBD oil, CBD gummies. I was going to bed at night after training. I'm so exhausted that I'm going to sleep. I'm not hanging out. I'm not staying up. You know, I go home, eat my final meal of the night, and go to bed, get up early for my, you know, AM session. My recovery, you know, I was going to get my massages and my sports massages and, you know, meticulous diet. I was, you know, no drinking, no smoking, you know, the things that I enjoy to do, none of that, because I set a focus and I set a goal, rather. And I've learned in my life what works for me. Anytime I've wanted to accomplish something, I've needed to have that laser beam like focus in order to achieve that goal. And I know that when I do that, it usually works for me in terms of being successful and achieving the goal I set. I wanted to be a world champion. So that's exactly what I was doing. I always say this, man, when I talk to people about competing, nowadays, jiu-jitsu is so popular. There are so many tournaments, small tournaments, you know, that aren't as big as say, you know, the IBJJF, because, you know, that's the governing body. That's deep water. That's the serious practitioners. Not to say that people do a Naga tournament aren't, you know, serious, but it's a lot looser. It's not as strenuous. You know, they're a little more user-friendly, if you will. And I tell people, if you want to compete, do a Naga tournament. Do a couple of Naga tournaments just to, you know, get your feet wet and get the tournament.
I think you tossed that idea to me a couple of years ago, too.
Yeah.
I feel like you were like, yeah, just do a Naga one. They do just tons down there. I feel like I remember us. Yeah, you're right. You know you're right.
Just dive in, Freddie. Dive in.
You'll have to come with me. You'll be my corner man, bro.
I absolutely will.
That would be amazing.
Hey, hold on. I'm going to put you on the spot right now. You commit that you will do a tournament right now, and I will commit to fly out and be your corner man.
Let's do that, man. I would really love that. Like, I would really love that. Let's
I'll
do it. We'll
better.
Find.
I'll compete too.
We'll find the right one. We'll find the right one where you have some time.
We'll compete on the same Naga. You corner me, and I'll corner you.
I'll let John Jocks corner you, and you can both.
No,
corner me.
You
want his voice, not mine.
This is you and me. This is you and me.
Okay.
Digital handshake right now. You corner me. I'll corner you.
No one can see it but you and I, but that's a digital handshake. So let me ask you a question about WWE, since I feel I've lacked on that. We just nerded out on jiu-jitsu.
Oh, yeah, we just completely nerded out on jits.
You made the transition from wrestling in the ring every single week to becoming a part of someone who I felt always needed that perfect key to help unlock this business for him. And that was the relationship with you and Bobby Lashley. And I'm wondering, can you talk about, is that a long-term plan? Was it a week-to-week thing? How do you go from linking up, creating the Hurt Business, to all of a sudden the road to WrestleMania?
I think, you know, Bobby and I have a wonderful relationship. We've been friends for a really long time. From my very first run on SmackDown, Bobby was the one that told me that I would win the United States Championship. We bet a steak dinner on it. And because I didn't believe it at the time, and I was never so happy to buy somebody dinner. And then, you know, over the years, Bobby and I stayed in touch. You know, we were in Japan together, not for the same company, but we were over there hanging out. And then we were over at, you know, another company together for a while where we had a really good pairing and really good chemistry. So when I came back to the WWE and they put us together, it's a very organic, natural relationship that translates
you can see
well
that.
To the screen. As Bobby continued to improve, I think our synergy and our act just continued to ferment, I guess, you know, until it got to that point where like, oh yeah, that tastes about right. Yeah. And
yeah, man.
Vince reassessed Bobby and his role and felt that, okay, he's ready. I'll never forget. I remember leaving the WWE, asking for my release to go to Japan. And, you know, they told me, hey, the door's open when you're ready to come back. And a decade later, I came back for a one-off and ended up staying, you know.
Yeah. By the way, I remember that night. You're like, nah, it's just a one-time thing. And then I'm like, I see you every week on television. What happened to the one-time thing?
That was an accident. You know, the card's subject to change, you know. But I remember being in Tampa at WrestleMania, and you know, this is the first, because they had to cancel WrestleMania, you know, in front of fans. Remember that, the pandemic.
That's right.
So they had WrestleMania in the Performance Center.
That's right.
This is the first time we were able to have WrestleMania with limited fans, you know, outdoors. But I'm walking down the ramp at WrestleMania with one of my closest friends and the WWE champion. And
listen to how you just said that. Listen to how you just, and the W, like, it's almost like it's still not real, man. It is so real. Everybody loves it.
But it was at the moment, it was surreal, because I'm thinking to myself, man, you know, I remember eating yakiniku with this dude in Roppongi at midnight, you know.
Bro, you guys used to post Instagram photos of you guys hanging out together in Japan with a Guinness in one hand and some tempura in the other. And I was like, this guy is loving life. I didn't know you guys were that tight, though, until I saw you come together again on Raw. And I was like, yo, they're for real friends. Because fans are slick now, man. They know. They know when it's forced.
So it's amazing, you know, to WrestleMania. You know, the Super Bowl of professional wrestling, one of the biggest entertainment extravaganzas on the planet. And, you know, to be there in a major role with one of my closest friends, you know, representing the WWE Championship. And, you know, every year when WrestleMania comes around, as you know, we're in WrestleMania season now, the road to WrestleMania is upon us. And we'll be in Dallas, Texas for two nights, because WrestleMania is so big that it's two nights now, Saturday and Sunday.
I love the two-day format. It just gives me more
insane
time to nerd out.
Bananas. And if you think about it, WrestleMania has, you know, it like the any major sporting event, you know, whatever their championship is, there's always that whole week leading up to it. And WrestleMania is no different now. Now you've got a whole week of events that lead up to the two big shows. And, you know, the cottage industries that have popped up around all the independent shows, and you've got,
oh
so
my gosh, yeah. There's superstars doing comedy clubs WrestleMania week at every comedy club in every city they go
everything
to.
Everything is booked. Everything, every venue, everything is booked, because everybody converges on whatever city WrestleMania is in. for one of the biggest events on the planet, and it keeps getting bigger. And every time I think, okay, well, how are they going to top last year? Somehow they do every year.
Yo, that's a real statement. I remember thinking that last time when it was up where the 49ers play at Levi Stadium and being like, I don't know how good WrestleMania is going to be. And that was the famous Seth Rollins finisher into Randy's RKO when he tried right. to get the curb stomp and he launched him like 10 feet. And I was like, yeah, okay, I was wrong again. WrestleMania is still the sickest show that happens every single year. Well, listen, man, if I can get my butt out to WrestleMania, we need to hang out. If not, I'm going to see you at a Southern California Jiu-Jitsu tournament, but I really hope I get to see you before then. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I know how busy you guys are. You know I love you. You know I always appreciate you. And I appreciate everybody here for listening.
This has been a production of iHeart's My Cultura Podcast Network. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.